Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Civil rights activist and professor Coley Clark will be the keynote speaker of the 16th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Labor Celebration on the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday on Monday at the William S. Hackett Middle School in Albany, January 19th from 12 to 3:30 p.m. Coley Clark is a civil rights activist and former College of St. Rose, Union College, and SUNY Albany adjunct professor, a Mississippi native who was involved with the civil rights movement during her teenage and college years. Clark was a special assistant for slain Mississippi NAACP leader Medgar Evers at the time of his June 1963 assassination. It is a great pleasure to welcome Coley Clark to the roundtable this morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
I'm excited. Looking forward to coming to Albany. I see Barbara Smith is out doing what she does best, which is anything connected with media. She is such a wonderful woman. I'm just excited to come up at Albany Solidarity Committee for the Capital Region, the Capital Region Labor Federation, and all those wonderful people that I miss. I was in Albany almost 17 years. So that's the only place I've been that long after I left my hometown of Jackson is Albany.
The name of the event is being called Step Up, Take Back the Dream. What is the message that you want to get across in your words?
I want to get across two messages at Albany. One, that young people have grasped the reins of leadership and that they now are stepping up and they are taking back the dream. The dream was the unfinished march, as it has been labeled, and that is that we've got a Civil Rights Act, a Voting Rights Act, but we did not get the other parts of the dream from the March on Washington speech in 1963. Have not gotten off the roof the dream of full unemployment for the nation and inclusive unemployment with a wage that was a livable wage. We have not gotten Roy Wilkins' speech of talking about a quality, inclusive education for this nation. He didn't talk about a universal education. Of course, I'm speaking of a universal education. And I'm taking it beyond, step beyond President Obama, and I salute him for talking about free community college, because we need that, but we need it straight through terminal degrees. And then we did not talk about housing for the nation, which was one of the other areas that James Former would have brought us, but he was in jail at the time and did not speak at the march, but his speech was at the march. So now how do we deal with housing? How do we deal with unemployment, which is critical for the black community? We're seldom below 12% of employed people. And now we're talking about generation after generation of people who have never been employed in the United States since 1929, 1930. So to deal with the more critical issues, which is education, employment, housing, and, of course, the young people are talking about revamping the criminal justice system. So that's the unfinished part of this dream of Dr. King.
How optimistic are you that the young people who have the reins, as you say, are able to do something with them?
I'm very, very optimistic. Despite the government crackdown and people are not talking about the fact that Homeland Security has been arrested in St. Louis, Missouri, and in the Ferguson area, probably other places in the country, because there's more than 800 cities that have been involved in these protests. Despite that crackdown, young people are continuing as we never have before. You know, civil rights movement, we never had this, where young people have been in the streets in cold weather, straight through, since last summer. New York today, they're downtown, and they're actively engaged in talking about change. My only fear for young people, and that is the advantage of having an older generation who should have gotten out of the way, held it down 50 years, and that was to the disadvantage of this nation and its development, for any one group of people to hold down any one area of the political economy. And we held down this whole area called civil rights, my generation. So they've taken it over, but the fear is that they may perceive of the prosecution issue and the criminal justice system as being an end in itself. Ella Baker put it admirably when she was speaking with students in the 1960s when they were screaming at each other about the facets of nonviolence, whether it's going to be civil disobedience or voter registration. She said, look, folks, the movement is bigger than a hamburger. So these young people have to understand that the movement is much bigger than the criminal justice system.
Mm.
We are talking about the full political economy of the United States. And when we look at the March on Washington 63, where all of the elements are laid, well, the major elements are laid out there, then we are able to see a full picture, and that they have to make it their business to take on each component of these. What I love the most about them is there's no identifiable leadership. Now, that Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee at its best. Well, we said, let there not be one leader, but let us all be leaders. So therefore, if they kill one, 10 will replace us.
Mm.
And these young people are set to do that. However, they have got to be more critical and get into us a clearer agenda.
What brought you to Selma, Alabama in the early 1960s?
1963, third month of my marriage, my first husband and I, responding to a call from James Foreman, the executive director for Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, that the Atlanta Constitution had him in the papers every day. He was supposedly dying. Bernard goes up to see him in Atlanta. We were at Tampa, Florida, his Bernard's hometown. And Jim, you know, just impressed upon him the importance of us doing what Dr. King had refused to do, and that is SCLC was not going to go to Selma, not going to go to Dallas County, not going to go into the seven black belt Alabama counties, and how desperately they needed somebody. King and his forces weren't going because they were scared of the violence of the area. He had come through on the People to People March, had been extremely violent, came through in 61. So we decided that Jim was dying, it was his last request, and that we should go to Selma and set up headquarters there for the seven black belt counties. So we arrived in Selma February 63, welcomed by Mrs. Boynton and the Dallas County Voters League, which had been there since 1933. So we're arriving 30 years later as young people to bring in some new energy, to begin to talk about some literacy schools, but not just for Selma and Dallas County, but for all seven of the Black Belt counties. So we were there then to, as Student Nonviolent Coordinator, committed to do what no other group in the civil rights movement would do, and that was to go to the hardcore places, to actually go into the rural countryside, to actually go to where the mob lived, to do the work of making change.
And that work is evidenced just by the timeline. When we see the Selma movement that is, of course, the subject of the now Oscar-nominated picture, that you look at it and say, okay, but this is the work that you all were doing on the ground 2 years before that, of how long and slow that work was being done.
You're not only how long and slow, how ignored by the press. Fall of 1964, well, for the whole summer of 64, when we have this great movement going on in the state of Mississippi called the Mississippi Summer Project. There is at Selma, Bernard and I left Selma August of 63. So this is a year later, about a year later. We have more than 120 young people jailed in Selma for doing the voter registration work, for sit-ins and sit-downs at various facilities in the Selma area, and more than 120 of them are in jail, located out there in one of those old army bases. No relief whatsoever, no mention in the press. Marion Barry will spend the whole summer, the late Marion Barry now,
mm-hmm.
who was the mayor of D.C., will spend the summer of 64 in Chicago working with Handrahan, who will be involved with the killing of the young man there in 69. Trying to force him to deal with the people who are in jail at Selma, to try to force him to deal with the people who are in jail at America's Alabama, where 12 little girls are in a 10 by 12 cell, no toilet facilities, and given one hamburger a day. This was a crisis in media. Media was focused on the Mississippi Summer Project And for whatever their reasons may have been, they would not cover either Selma or America's Georgia. We have to put all the pieces together when we look at the civil rights movement, because a part of the reason that we got a successful movement has to be assigned to media, to the coverage by media. And we learned after a while how to manipulate media, you know what I mean? We
right.
knew that if we did certain things, we'd get national media, did some other things, we'd go get international media. And nobody wanted to be embarrassed. One didn't want to embarrass the other. But we also began to understand that media had a connection with government, so that Lyndon Johnson could say, don't cover Fannie Lou Hamer at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City in 1964. We began to understand those things. But when you look at Selma, you got to understand that in light of Dr. King being down, wasting his time down in at the oldest city in the United States and the oldest slavery in the United States, at St. Augustine, Florida, talking about desegregating some beaches and some lunch counters when he was so desperately needed in Mississippi, full time. He did come to Mississippi the summer of 64, but was needed there full time. But they just needed to have this separate peace over here to themselves. And because of that separate peace to themselves, it destroyed that Dr. King's fundraising base. They lost funding. NHP got all the funds for the summer of 64 because there was plenty of money that came in, but it went to the group that wasn't doing the work, the NAACP.
Mm.
Not the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Congress for Racial Equality, who were the mainline groups along with SCLC, Dr. King's group, there in the state of Mississippi. It went to NAACP, the top groups, not to Mississippi NAACP, I might add. So what you see happening then is Dr. King has to figure out, his forces have to figure out, how do they regroup their funding base? And so they made a deal, I know now, and my first son will scream at me and say it's not true, but I know it is true. But they made a deal with him, and I'm saying it because I will not be held responsible for turning my back on SNCC. And the deal was that they would go to Selma, and to get in, you needed the Lafayette's. In fact, people, they almost still thought Bernard is some kind of a king, a priest at Dr. at Selma, because he was struck the same night that Medgar was killed.
Mm.
He got his head busted, front page of New York Times, in a failed assassination attempt. And I thank Max Shannon, I thank him to this day, that lived above us. He was a sharpshooter from the Korean War, heard us rumble outside and fired off a shot, just decided he'd shoot in the air. And it forced away the four men who were trying to abduct Bernard. So when you look at this man who then will make a deal to take the power of that imagery, the power of his presence with Dr. King's people to bring them in, because he wanted to be on the King's staff. And that's where he landed. But on the other hand, it was a disadvantage to the entire historic movement, because the students then are forced to do what? Pay the second seat. So it winds up with these little constant bickering between SCLC and SNCC, back and forth between Stokely Carmichael, a.k.a. Kwame Ture, and Jim Foreman, our executive director, and Dr. King and his staff. Less Dr. King and more the staff at Selma. So I was at Selma in 65. I was into very far gone with a pregnancy. I had the child in April, but I stayed as long as I could. My influence there was very little because Bernard had made the deal. It heightened the tensions between the two groups. But it was a successful venture when it was all over. The only problem with the final conclusion, it looked like Selma was the real stage for the right to vote, as opposed to all of the Black Belt counties of the South, all of Alabama and all of the South, and New York State that had a literacy law.
There,
so people don't get a chance to look at the full impact of the Voting Rights Act that also would include New York State, which had a literacy law that violated people who came from outside of the country, primarily immigrants.
Because of that aspect of success of the Selma marches, do you look at it as successful, or that history can still be more accurate and would be more successful if the work that was done there was spotlighted more?
Yeah, I think if the work was that was done not just at Selma, but in the Black Belt counties and in all the counties of Mississippi, in Arkansas. You get where I'm going? South Carolina and North Carolina and Georgia. That we have to look, historically looking, the historian looking. I'm not a historian, I'm a novice historian. But at looking at the picture of that time period, I always frame it from the early 1900s and the Niagara Movement. Because if you don't frame it there, then we won't have any clarity, because it's here that we are just beginning to kind of lift ourselves up a little bit from the heavy knockdown of black Reconstruction in this country. So it begins in the early 1900s, the mass riots in St. Louis and other places, and St. Louis is just recovering now and getting back on its feet. Looking forward, these mass voter registration campaigns will go across the South, and the cotton movement and everything else. So it's like an ebb and a flow. But there's always these voter registration drives, and that's why my parents were registered voters, because these voter registration drives were always there, and people were always taking these risks. So we've got to frame it in that way in order to be fair to history, to all of the men and women and children who gave their lives in that time period. Doing what? Trying to just secure a basic American legal right, which was the right to vote.
Coley, what was it like for you to vote for the first time?
Just a vote. I was not even excited about it because I was about now. By the time I voted for the first time, I was a very anti what was the new movement. So, yeah, it was all right. It was a good experience. It was good to know that if I wanted to participate in the political process, I would. And so I did it with Jesse Jackson when he was running for president. I decided I would support Jesse. I'd been the editor for the Jackson, Mississippi Advocate, and that I ought to do the right thing and go down and vote for Jesse and actually support Jesse's campaign. So it was a good feeling, but it was nothing spectacular, because I don't know what I changed. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you want the vote, but you want to feel that, you know, that my vote counts for something. And so a lot of people don't vote, especially a lot of so-called intellectuals, because they don't know that it counts for anything.
So the
overhauling of the political process is something that we've got to work on.
So with a Voting Rights Act, you would think that there would be, at least with all of the work that you had done in these counties, that it would be a great source of pride to go to the polls and vote. But you're saying to me that you didn't go until almost 25 years later in the late 1980s to vote for Jesse Jackson.
Yeah, because I politically matured. And so what I'm saying is that, you know, I encourage people to vote. In fact, I run for office. I ran for Senate twice.
Right here in New York, yes.
Came in through number three each time.
Right, in the Green Party.
Right here in New York.
Yeah.
But I'm saying to people that there is a level of political maturity. Go vote. There's no excuse for not voting. Be involved in the political process. But for those of us who have come the long journey, there were points in our careers where we were so discouraged by the outcome of the civil rights struggle that we paid such a hell of a price. But we had not expected the kickback from the U.S. government and all of its forces upon those of us who paid that price. There was a kickback that put drugs in every community, a kickback that killed hundreds upon hundreds of Black Panthers, a kickback that meant that we were forced to either bow to the system to get jobs to feed our children, or we were forced to go into insane asylums, or we were forced to leave the United States of America. That kickback came. It came hard. It came down on all of us. And for those who decided they would sell to it and just take some big jobs and not pay, it may have seemed it was all right. But for those of us who are looking on, who got enough intelligence to measure what's happening with the system, it was not a good moment. So for me, it was not a good moment.
Did you ever feel, or do you still feel, betrayed by Martin Luther King and his movement?
No, I never felt betrayed by Martin Luther King. Not by Martin Luther King. I'm not too sure his movement didn't betray him. I've never been betrayed by Martin Luther King. I think Martin Luther King was genuine. My work with him in Chicago, where I spent 1965 and 66 with Dr. King. My work with him in the peace movement, 67 with Dr. King. I got a chance to know King, the man. He was genuine, one of the most brilliant people to ever walk this planet. And he was sensitive. He was human. Now, there are always, within any movement, those other folk who may not be as genuine, may not be as sensitive, sometimes I think may not be as human, but not Dr. King. So I never betrayed by that movement and his forces. I think if there was any betrayal at all on the civil rights side, it could come with a combination of all the forces, beginning with the big ones, NAACP. But SCLC, like SNCC, we were the youthful groups, the last groups out. And we never grew quite to that point of being NAACP.
Did you ever feel, for want of a better term, victorious, that you had won something?
I like you. I like you.
I like you too.
that I had won something. Yes, but it wasn't something necessarily within civil rights. I think that when Kwame Ture stood on a road in Mississippi, Stokely Carmichael, and screamed Black Power, which I think ultimately will be the victory for the 20th century, will be our big victory. Scream Black Power, and within a two-week period, people were, hairs were changing, and people were walking around in African clothing. There were no sympathy, no patterns in simplicity and vogue. So people out of nowhere came out of our heads, out of nowhere. We reclaimed our humanity. Humanity. That moment in 66, on a road in Mississippi, Will Stokely was trying to embarrass Dr. King, will scream Black Power, and Dr. King will say, "And it is beautiful to be black." That was a moment that gave us humanness. You couldn't call me black in 1965, 66, before that moment. I would call you every name under the sun and hit you in your head. Because slavery had created such a depravity with us that we were at a point where we just could not be Africans, could not be humans. But we're humans now. We still struggle back and forth with what we ought to look like, but we're at least human beings again. We have not reclaimed our languages, but the genocide, the rampant genocide upon us and the menticide that led us to 1966 was a moment when it was overthrown by the call for Black Power. And I should always respect Kwame, wherever he is in glory, hell, wherever he is these days, for that moment in history. And I will respect Dr. King for understanding youth in that moment and understanding that this wild boy who had made this wild statement, and rather than going against it, gave it meaning by saying, "Yes, you know, and it is beautiful to be black." We were human beings at last.
You are going to be talking about the unfinished march when you speak on Monday in Albany.
Yes.
Do you feel that this march will ever be finished, or is it important that it is never really finished?
Well, nothing is ever really finished, but let me say this. The unfinished march is really the unfinished work of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who on January 11th, 1944, speaking of his State of the Union address, talked about an economic bill of rights. What Franklin Roosevelt brought to the nation for the first time was that growth had taken place and that the first Bill of Rights of 1792 was not adequate to serve Americans. So we needed a new economic Bill of Rights, eight points, that would address housing, education, farmers, the elderly, right down the line, health. The whole works. So if you get a chance, I don't know whether you visited it before, look for his economic Bill of Rights.
Yes.
Because that is what was at the March on Washington. Following the March on Washington, there will be immediately set up a council of more than 236 people who will be working on the development of a Bill of Rights, an economic program with Dr. King at the helm. Quietly they did their work. But the scholars and, you know, and religious leaders and everybody that you could dream on, labor leaders from around this country and world, who worked on trying to come up with an economic peace that would be put in place. And this is what was being pushed down and squashed by the right-wing forces in the United States. That silent peace that was being done behind the scenes, so to speak. But it's that economic Bill of Rights that we need that was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's project, and we need to embrace it. We need to embrace it as quickly as possible. It's 8 little short points, but it's a history, political economy for the nation and for the world. Because if America can put in place universal education, universal health care, just begin to universal child care, just begin to see how that will play out in the world where we paid. We actually paid for socialism in Europe. America financed socialism in Europe so that Britain has socialized medicine. Sweden's got socialized medicine. France got socialized medicine. Spain's got socialized medicine. Germany, who we fought, got socialized medicine. And we scream about some underdeveloped Obamacare program because we are just not willing to be honest. Now, when I'm talking about that, we are not talking about the American people. I am talking about the capitalists who run this country. Not willing to be honest. We got to become honest. And we got to move to a point where we can have universal education, universal child care, health care, where we can have decent, affordable housing for every human being in this country, where we can have full unemployment, where everybody in the country knows that if I want to be a business person, I can go into business with the aid of my government. We have got to come to that point. We have the resources to do it. We just don't have the will. We need the will. And when that point comes, we will have at least begun to enter the age of civilization in the United States. And we will then be legitimately the leaders for the world.
Civil rights activist and professor Coley Clark will be the keynote speaker of the 16th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Labor Celebration at William S. Hackett Middle School in Albany on Monday, January 19th from 12 to 3:30 p.m. Coley Clark, a great pleasure to have you on the program. What an honor to speak to you and to hear your wonderful words.
I've really been excited by you. I like you.
Right,
I generally
back
don't
to
like the press. I'm lying, but I do like you. Thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to meeting you at Albany.
Thank you so much. What a great pleasure. Again, Coley Clark will be the speaker of the 16th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Labor Celebration at William Hackett Middle School in Albany, Monday, January 19th from 12 to 3:30. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.